Zachary, I'll guarantee you that I'll never again regret having a topic instead of a text after Brother Roger Rush's lesson. I will repent of ever having said that. It's so great to be with you. Great to be on your program. Great to see the progress this school is making. It seems strange to be introduced as being from West Virginia after having spent my life in Pennsylvania up until 1999. But the folks down in West Virginia now have me feeling like a West Virginian. I never believed I'd ever like to preach anywhere as well as at Kittanning, but the folks at Berkeley Springs have just treated me so wonderfully. In fact, I wasn't there but about a month until one of the ladies come up after services and she said to me, "Well, that's the sorriest sermon I ever heard in my life. You ought to be ashamed. You'll stand in judgment one day and give account for that kind of preaching." And I was just devastated. This other sweet lady came up and she said, "Oh, don't pay any attention to her." She said she never had an original thought in her life. All she does is repeat what she hears other people say. But it is good to be here, and it's great to see the good work you're doing. Certainly appreciate the fact that some of the preacher students are here this morning, and I had some privilege you had. I sat under Brother Charles Pugh and Brother Charles Abbey, and we had Brother Abbey over at Berkeley Springs to hold a teacher's workshop, and one of our members said, "Did you teach Clarence?" He said, "I tried to." But as we begin this study of true and false prophets, it seems to me at least that one of the logical places to begin is with the definition of the terms. The Apostle Peter warned in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1, "But there were false prophets among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you." And the word translated false prophets is pseudo-prophetes. And Thayer says that it means one who, acting the part of a divinely inspired prophet, utters falsehoods in the name of divine prophecies. And we recognize the prefix pseudo, and Webster defines pseudo as being apparently rather than actually as stated. So a false prophet is one who only appears to be delivering inspired messages from God, when a true prophet is indeed delivering inspired messages. And I want us to think about a very faith-building prophecy in Zechariah. And as Brother Smith Bauer said yesterday, and has already been said this morning, chapter 9 begins a section of Zechariah where the prophet looks into the future and foretells the fulfillment of a great covenant promise made to David in 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 and following. When Nathan came to David and said that while you're buried and in the ground, the God of heaven will raise up one of your seed to sit in your throne, and he will reign forever, and he will build a house for thy name. And then Matthew quotes Zechariah 9:9 in the 21st chapter of Matthew, in that passage that we've come to call the triumphant entry. And Mark, speaking of that same occasion in chapter 11, verse 10, says that that group who heralded his coming met his coming by crying out, "Blessed be the kingdom of our father David that cometh in the name of the Lord." Then move with me to the New Testament, when Jesus is setting forth the principles of the kingdom in the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew chapter 7 and verse 16, he said, "Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves." And the Jews on the day of Pentecost, looking to this kingdom, I heard of this kingdom, as Brother Frank pointed out last night when Peter stood up and declared that by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you've taken by wicked hands and crucified and slain the very Messiah of whom Nathan had told David would one day come. And then, when he got to the climax of that sermon, he told that assembled audience that through this man's blood, there was remission of sins available from that point forward. And that is exactly what Zechariah had in mind in chapter 13, verses 1 through 4, in a passage that Brother Higginbotham dealt with so masterfully last night. "In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And I will also cause the prophet and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. And it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and mother that begat him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live, for thou prophesiest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesieth. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed every one of his vision when he hath prophesied, neither shall they wear the rough garment to the sea. Now the pulpit commentary points out that this is talking about false prophets, and argues on the basis of it being in a context and parallel with the unclean spirits, and cites the Septuagint translation and the Vulgate translation as also supporting the idea that these are false prophets. And indeed, I believe they are, but that's not the extent of the passage, because what I believe that he has in view here is the end of the miraculous. And he's saying, in that day, the prophet and the unclean spirit will pass out of the land. And for that very reason, if any will yet prophesy, then those who are dearest on earth to him, his father and mother, are obligated to tell him, Thou shalt die and not live, for thou prophesieth lies in the name of the Lord. Since there would no longer be any inspired men, anyone claiming to prophesy would immediately be recognized as a liar. And so the threat of death at the hands of those dearest on earth to him would discourage any would-be deceivers from wearing the mantle of a prophet. It's exactly the idea that we have in 1 Corinthians, chapter 13, verses 9 and 10, where Paul said, we know in part and we prophesy in part. When that which is perfect is come, these things which are in part shall pass away. So in that day, when Revelation had been complete, the prophet, very nature of the case, would be an obsolete office. And anyone claiming to be a prophet would immediately be recognized as being a liar. Now, I want you to consider how that harmonizes with what the New Testament teaches. The passage we've already mentioned, Matthew 7 and verse 16, beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravening wolves. And then John in 1 John 4, verse 1, said, Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they be of God, for many false prophets are gone out into the world. And so John's own writing demonstrates the very nature that he's writing by inspiration, that he's still living in the age of the miraculous, but he looks ahead and tells his people that are still living in that time to put people to the test who claim that they're speaking by inspiration. And in contrast to that now, let's go back to the passage we began with, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 1, where Peter said, But there were false prophets among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you. Now, for those who are fascinated by the evidence of inspiration, I would suggest to you that this passage has the fingerprints of God all over it. Peter is warning Christians of the dangers they will face after Revelation's complete. But he doesn't use the term false prophets. He uses the term false teachers because from inspiration's point of view, once the prophet doesn't exist, the false prophet doesn't exist. I think Brother Franklin Camp was right in something I heard him say one time, that the term false prophet is meaningless as far as inspiration's concerned if there is no such thing as a true prophet. It'd be like saying, talking about a counterfeit $3 bill. That would be a ridiculous expression. In fact, I heard a story about that. There was a man up there in Pennsylvania who was counterfeiting. And he wasn't the brightest fellow in the world. Made a mistake. He counterfeited $30 bills. He said, Now, we've got this big bunch of $30 bills. What are we going to do with them? Well, the fellow said, We're just going to take them down to West Virginia. He said, We'll find some old mountaineer back in the country. He won't have any better sense than to change it for us. So they came down into West Virginia, one of the counties up in the hills, and they found this mountaineer and this old hillbilly. And so they went into him and they said, Would you mind changing a $30 bill for me? And he said, Why, certainly. He said, Would you like to have 3 nines and a three? Or would you want me to give you 4 sevens and a nine? But you can't have a counterfeit $3 bill. And you can't have a counterfeit prophet if there are no prophets. People of God ought to recognize if there are no prophets, anyone who claims to be a prophet would be telling a lie. Now, of course, there are false prophets in the sense that Ellen G. White and Joseph Smith were false prophets, but I'm talking about inspiration would be demeaning itself if it talked about false prophets after the original and the true passed from the scene. But with all that said, I think it's important to recognize that the same seductive forces of culture that produced false prophets are at the root of much false teaching today. And I believe that this is the area where our study together will prove to be most profitable. God gave his prophets credentials to authenticate their message. In the book of Genesis, chapter 20, when Abraham and Sarah had hatched the plot to pretend that they were brother and sister, and God closed the wombs of all the women of Gerar, he appeared to the king of Gerar, Abimelech, in a dream, and he told them that Abraham was a prophet, and that, of course, Sarah was his wife. And he authenticated the fact that Abraham was a prophet by the very dream by which that was revealed to Abimelech. And then when Abraham prayed on behalf of the people of Gerar, and God opened up their wombs, that was a revelation of God to them and a ratification of the fact that Abraham indeed was a prophet of God. In Exodus chapter 4, we're told that both Moses and Aaron were prophets. And in verse 15, he said, "I will be with thy mouth and with his mouth." And in Exodus 4, verse 17, he said, "And thou shalt take this rod in thine hand, wherewith thou shalt do signs." And you remember whenever Moses protested that, well, Pharaoh wouldn't believe him, that he's appeared to us, he said, "Throw that rod down." And do that, he said, that'll convince him. Incidentally, anybody who coined that phrase, "slow as Moses," wasn't standing there whenever that rod turned into a snake. And if I'd have been standing there, Moses wouldn't have been able to keep up. Miracles and signs were given to prophets to authenticate their messages. And Paul often opposed the claims of false prophets to appeal to that very thing by urging those that false prophets were trying to confuse by asking them to prove them by asking them to work a miracle. For example, in the book of Galatians, chapter 3, verse 5, he said, "He therefore that ministereth to you the Spirit and worketh miracles among you, doeth it by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith?" And what Paul's really saying to the Galatians is, look, you've got Judaizers there who are trying to corrupt you. You go ask them to work a miracle. Who was it that imparted miraculous gifts to you? Was it me and my people, or was it the Judaizers? Now, some people mistakenly believe that false prophets could work miracles. But if false prophets could work miracles, then in what sense could miracle-working power be the credentials of a spokesman for God? The false prophet has his first miracle to work yet. It's impossible. Never was and never will be a prophet, a miracle worked by a false prophet. We need to recognize that. I was up in Katanning about, I guess it's 20 years ago, and a knock came to the door, and my wife went to answer the door, and I was sitting out eating my evening meal in the kitchen, and I recognized that we had some Mormons visiting us. And after a while, she said, "Clarence, they want to talk to you." So I went in, and immediately they said, "We're here in the name of Jesus Christ to talk to you about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." And it was unfortunate. I don't have that much hair, but what I had stood. They were there by the authority of Christ to talk to me about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we began a conversation. He said to me, "Do you have apostles in your church?" And I said, "Oh, yes." "Well, who are they?" "Well," I said, "there was Peter and Andrew and James and John," and I started ticking them off. And he says, "That's not what I mean. I mean living apostles." I said, "Well, what do we need living apostles for? We have the work, the record of the work the apostles did. It's complete. Why do we need living apostles? Do you have prophets?" "Oh," I said, "sure." "Well, who are they?" "Well, Isaiah, Jeremiah." "Well, no," he said, "that's not what I mean. I mean living prophets." I said, "No, we don't have living prophets. Do you?" And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "I'm a prophet." I said, "You are?" "Yes," he said, "I am." I said, "Well, you know, prophets oftentimes could work miracles. Can you work miracles?" "Oh, yes." His friend says, "Well, I've seen him work them." "Oh," I said, "you have?" He said, "Why, sure I have." I said, "All right, just wait a minute." And I went in the kitchen, and I got a butcher knife about that long, and I laid it down on the coffee table, and I said, "My friend, you cut your finger off and put it back on, and I'll be a Mormon before this night's over." And he jumped up and he said, "You're tempting God." I said, "No, I'm not. I'm putting you to the test." I'm proving you. Now, you said you could work a miracle, work one. And of course, that ended his attempt to convert me. And my son asked me what I'd have done if he'd cut his finger off, and I told him I'd taken him to the hospital. What do you suppose I'd have done? But there was a second criterion by which the genuine apostles were to be judged. Because there was a possibility that someone might make a host of predictions of the Gene Dixon variety, and by consequence, some of those things come true. And God covered that eventuality in the 13th chapter of Deuteronomy. Beginning with verse 1 through verse 3, he said, "If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, and the sign or a wonder cometh to pass, whereof he spoke unto thee, saying, Let us go after other gods, which thou hast not known, and let us serve them, thou shalt not hearken unto that a prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord thy God proveth thee to know whether or not you love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul." And so Moses is not saying here that God equipped false prophets with the power to work miracles as a means of testing people whether they would be true to God or not. But what he is saying is that God does allow things in the nature of coincidence to occur. And the second criterion by which prophets were to be judged to be true or not was whether his message harmonized with everything else all other inspired men had delivered down through the ages. Moses' example would be obviously a contradiction to the very first commandment of the Decalogue, "Thou shalt have no other God before me." And so Moses made it clear that this would be a sign of a false prophet. So if by coincidence a prediction of a false prophet came true, and he were used that fortuitous accident to call for a worship of false gods, and that he was to be rejected. And so the authentic prophet not only demonstrated his truthfulness by miracles and signs, but by also speaking in a way that harmonized with every other revelation God had ever made. And Deuteronomy chapter 13 verses 1 to 3 stands as a monument to the fact that all those who search for contradictions in the Bible search in vain. Well, what could possibly motivate one to prophesy falsely? The answer is neither difficult nor surprising. Beyond that, the answer is extremely relevant. When false prophets are in the majority, those who have the courage to stand for truth will often find themselves in the crucible of suffering. The Bible records a very courageous prophet who lived and prophesied during the reign of the notorious Ahab, king of Israel. 2 Chronicles chapter 18 is the passage, if you might want to follow, where Ahab, king of Israel, and Jehoshaphat was king of Judah. And 2 Kings chapter 18, or chapter 8, verse 18, records the fact that Jehoshaphat's son had married Ahab's daughter, and this might in part explain why there's this strange alliance between them. But at any rate, in 2 Chronicles 18, Ahab comes to Jehoshaphat and wants him to align his forces with the forces of Ahab so that they might war against the king of Syria. And evidently he made this request after they had a sumptuous feast in Samaria. But Jehoshaphat says, "Well, let's inquire of the Lord." And so Ahab called 400 prophets, and those 400 prophets to a man advised them that they go up against Ramoth-Gilead. Evidently, Jehoshaphat was all too familiar with Ahab and his prophets, because he says in 2 Chronicles 18, verse 6, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord besides that we might inquire of him?" And, of course, Ahab replied, "Yes, there's one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, because he never prophesies good to me, but only evil. The same as Micaiah, the son of Imlah." And so the order went out to fetch Micaiah. The two kings arrayed themselves in their robes. They sit on the throne outside the gates of Samaria. And these 400 prophets are prophesying before them, all with one accord saying, "You need to go up against Ramoth-Gilead." One of them, his name is Zedekiah, fashioned himself a set of iron horns. And I can picture him prancing around with those horns on his head saying, "With these thou shalt push Syria until they be consumed." Then the messenger comes with Micaiah. And now, as he brought him to the king, he said, "Behold, the words of the prophets declare good to the king with one assent. Let thy word, therefore, I pray thee, be as one of theirs, and speak thou good." 2 Chronicles 18, verse 12. And we are driven to admire his response. Micaiah said, "As the Lord liveth, what my God saith, that shall I speak." And Micaiah went into the presence of the king. And at first, we might be shocked at the advice he gives to Ahab. For Ahab asked if they should go up to Ramoth-Gilead or forbear. And Micaiah says, "Go ye up and prosper, and they shall be delivered into your hand." And the reaction in the next verse helps us to appreciate the fact that much communication is not by word, but a lot of nonverbal communication goes into one's teaching and preaching. Because Ahab responded, "How many times shall I adjure you that thou say nothing but truth unto me in the name of the Lord?" So you can picture how Micaiah said this. Yeah, you go ahead on up there. God's going to deliver them all in your hand. Just go right on up there. And he realized the way he was saying it, he's not telling him the truth. And so Micaiah responded that he'd seen Israel scattered upon the mountains like a sheep without a shepherd. And then he went on to say that God had permitted lying spirit to control the mouths of all the false prophets so that Ahab might be enticed to go up against Ramoth-Gilead and there perish. At that point, Zedekiah struck Micaiah over the cheek, and he said to him, "Which way went the Spirit of the Lord from me to speak unto thee?" 2 Chronicles 18, verse 23. And so Ahab ordered Micaiah to be put in prison on bread and water. And speaking the truth cost Micaiah his freedom, but believing a lie cost Ahab his life. Now, the challenge to all who would declare the truths of God in every age is a challenge that grows out of the pressure placed on us by a culture to conform to what might be politically correct in our time. There's nothing new about the notion of political correctness. This is still the greatest challenge faced by those who would dare to declare the gospel of Jesus Christ. 3 centuries down the stream of time from Micaiah, another situation arose that called for heroes. We've been talking about it all this week. Jerusalem is under attack by the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. And there's a man in Jerusalem who may be described surely by the same words that describe John the Immerser. For he was a voice in the wilderness, a voice crying alone while all those around him, the false prophets, were calling him a liar. And in the book of Jeremiah chapter 5, verses 30 and 31, he wrote, "A wonderful and horrible thing has happened in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests bear rule by their means, and my people love to have it so. And what shall the end? What shall you do in the end thereof?" Now, Jeremiah's lack of popularity grew out of the fact that the false prophets are all saying that you need to just make some military alliance with Egypt and other people, and you won't have any problem. They won't be able to conquer us. And Jeremiah is saying, "We're going into captivity because God is sending us there because of our sin." The people of Jeremiah's time are very similar to many religious people today. They misunderstood the nature of God. They made the gross error of thinking that God's relationship with the people of Judah grew out of who they were rather than what they were. It was a mistake that we recognize on into the first century when Jesus had that confrontation with the Jews in John chapter 8. In verse 33, after he told them, "You'll know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," they said, "We be Abraham's seed. We're never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou you shall be made free?" It's a mistake to persist to this present day, and is evident in the fact that there are so many of our religious neighbors that believe that tragic error, that God has future blessings in store for the state of Israel. If you look at Jeremiah chapter 7, verses 1 through 11, I think we'll be able to see what fueled their obstinacy against Jeremiah's pronouncements. "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word, and say, Hear the word of the Lord, all ye of Judah, that enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust you not in lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to hurt to your hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. It's really the same thing that Brother Rush is just saying a little bit ago, that they need to purge themselves of sin if they expected God to be able to bless them. But you see, they kept saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. They didn't believe, because that temple was there, and they associated God, the true and living God's presence with that temple, that Jerusalem would ever be taken. I want you to listen now, if you would, to some quotes from Jeremiah. You may want to follow along. Listen to what Jeremiah is saying in the response to some of these false prophets. In the book of Jeremiah, chapter 14, verses 13 through 16. Then said I, Ah, Lord God, behold, the prophets say unto them, Ye shall not see the sword, neither shall ye have famine, but I'll give you assured peace in this place. Then the Lord said unto me, The prophets prophesy lies in my name. I sent them not, neither have I commanded them, neither spake unto them. They prophesy unto you a false vision and divination, and the thing of naught, and the deceit of their heart. Therefore thus saith the Lord concerning the prophets that prophesy in my name, and I sent them not, yet they say, Sword and famine shall not be in this land. By sword and famine shall these prophets be consumed. And the people to whom they prophesy shall be cast out in the streets of Jerusalem because of the famine and the sword, and they shall have none to bury them, their wives and their sons and their daughters, for I'll pour their wickedness upon them. And then chapter 23, verses 13 to 15. And I have seen falling the prophets of Samaria. They prophesied in Baal and caused my people Israel to err. I've seen also in the prophets of Jerusalem a horrible thing. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They strengthen also the hands of evildoers, that none doth return from this wickedness. They are all of them unto me as Sodom, and the inhabitants thereof as Gomorrah. Therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts concerning the prophets, Behold, I will feed them with wormwood, and make them drink the water of gall. For from the prophets of Jerusalem is profane has gone forth into all the land. Chapter 23, verses 21 and 22. I have not sent these prophets, yet they ran. I have not spoken to them, yet they prophesied. But if they had stood in my counsel and had caused my people to hear my words, then they should have turned them from their evil way and from the evil of their doings. And that, I think, is sufficient for us to see that if we will preach the pristine gospel, that then America has hope. Without it, she has none. We, along with everyone who's ever lived on the earth, are subject to our cultures, and the winds of culture blow on us. There's a very favorite passage of mine that I'd like you to look to, just to use the metaphors that he used. The prophet is Habakkuk. And look with me to Habakkuk chapter 1. Habakkuk, of course, is receiving a revelation about the fact that the Chaldeans are going to take Jerusalem. He has an awful time with it. He can't understand how God can use people who are more wicked than even Judah to punish them. But I want to read from the first chapter, verse 5 beginning. Behold, ye among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess their dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses also are swifter than the leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. I love the language of the King James. I love the metaphors here. The horses of these Chaldeans will be swifter than leopards. They're like the evening wolves. Now notice, I didn't say wolves. He said the evening wolves. After the wolves have been in the den all day, and they're starving to death, and they're coming out hungry for their prey. But the passage I want to borrow, they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And think of that beautiful metaphor. As the armies of the Chaldeans come and they gather up the people of Judah, just like a tornado picks up something and then deposits it somewhere else. And back in 85, when we built the building there at Katanning, they had those tornadoes along the Ohio and Pennsylvania line. And there at the lot where we were building the building, we found store bills of people in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, about 75 miles away, that tornado had taken over to Katanning and dropped in our parking lot. And that's what this is saying, that these Chaldeans are going to pick up these people, and they're going to take them down into Babylonia, and they're going to drop them just like a sandstorm would pick up sand and deposit in the sand dune. And folks, that still happens. The winds of culture blow on people, and they gather up people, and they set them down together. Something that also happens when that happens, there are a few who are rooted and grounded who remain. Only a few like Elijah and Jeremiah and Micaiah stand against the tide of whatever political correctness is in their time. And at the present time, you and I live in a time like this, when the winds of culture blowing like hurricanes across our country. Those who would be faithful to Christ will have their courage tested. Mainstream America claims to be a Christian nation, but really the dominant religion in America is secular humanism. And it often infiltrates some of the mainstream religions and influences their teaching with their godlessness. The American culture is permeated by a liberalism that has an agenda. And that agenda is to remove every vestige of the Christian influence from America. And if you don't believe that, you just think about the ground they've captured when it comes to moral things like advancing the homosexual agenda, like the agenda of the militant feminists, like the abortion question, how they have attacked the sanctity of marriage, and on and on and on. And know how they've done it? They've done it under the banner of tolerance. And they brand anyone who dares stand up and say that such things as the practice of sodomy is abomination. Why? They've got a name for us: homophobe, or intolerant at the very least. G.K. Chesterton, the English essayist who wrote back in the early part of the 20th century, said, "Tolerance is the virtue of people who don't believe anything." I believe that's exactly right. Tolerance is the virtue of people who don't believe anything. Our sociologists are now wiser than Solomon. And that has resulted in schools where the paddle is out and condoms are in. Parents who would dare try to adopt Solomon's rule for raising a family risk being imprisoned, being put in jail because of child abuse. Folks, I grew up in a different time, a vastly different age. And if child abuse had been defined when I was a boy the way it is today, my mother would have died in the penitentiary. The mainstream media of America is an example how the winds of culture gather people together until they all speak with one voice. The CBS News Emmy Award-winning reporter Bernard Goldberg had the audacity to write a column for the Wall Street Journal, I'm trying to think of the name, Wall Street Journal, in which he alleged that there is an obvious bias in the mainstream media. And of course, he had reference, of course, to his own employer, CBS News. But this caused so much backlash that he was eventually ousted from CBS, and after that wrote a book called Media, in which he details how the major networks have a liberal mindset that has worked almost like a black hole to bring other liberals into their presence, and if anyone other than their mindset tries to penetrate, they can't. And he writes this: "If you hook network news reporters and producers to polygraph machines and ask them, 'Do you think you're guilty of liberal bias?' most would certainly answer no. And they would pass the polygraph test because they're not lying. They honestly believe what they're saying, and that's the biggest problem of all." And he goes on to say that some of these notions they have about the about our society, they really believe them deeply, and they think those of us who don't are stupid. And they look down on us with sort of an aloofness. And in a frighteningly similar way, there is evidence of the impact that our culture has on our Christian universities and our schools. I think this is the reason you folks have a great reason for your existence. One of the things that this grows out of is the fact that all schools are money-driven. And schools are tempted to stand for or against something based on what that's going to do to their constituency, the people who have to pay the bills. And so there is pressure there to say what people once said. It's no different than what Micaiah faced. You go on and say good things, see? The same winds of culture influence congregations. I've known elderships who refuse to take a stand against inroads being made by people in the congregation to teach what surely was religious error. Why? Because they were some of their most affluent members who were doing it. And again, it's money driven. And there's another force at work, and that is a desire to advance in those institutions. Those intent on promotions are very unlikely to take a position on any major thing that is in conflict with what the administration says, especially if they want to stay there. This is further advanced by the requirements for advanced degrees, and I'm certainly not minimizing how wonderful those are by men who are wise enough to keep their feet in the ground while they're getting them. But there is a tendency sometimes to stand in awe of anyone that has an advanced degree. Larry, I remember a man with a PhD that came to Pennsylvania, and at our preachers' meetings, the preachers thought that this fella was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I was expecting any time for him to demonstrate the ability to walk on water. But after being around him a few times and hearing what he was saying and some very fundamental things, I realized that PhD, in his case, stood for possibly half demented. Well, perhaps an even closer parallel to what's going on in the church and in our schools is what's going on in the judicial system. At this very moment, as I speak, there are countless numbers of men who are bottled up in the U.S. Senate who will not be considered for appointment to the bench because they're perceived as too conservative. Judge Robert Bork was savaged whenever he was placed before the U.S. Senate as a candidate for the Supreme Court. I don't know what you think about it, but I think that was the greatest mistake that could have been made. I don't believe there's a better constitutional lawyer alive than Robert Bork. And he wrote a book called The Tempting of America. And he describes a revisionist attitude in the courts that ignores the original understanding in favor of reinterpreting the Constitution of the United States in a way that will allow this liberal agenda to be advanced. And let me tell you what I mean by that. They found a phantom right of privacy in the U.S. Constitution. It's not there. But you know that. You know also they found the separation of church and state that's not there. Those things aren't in the Constitution. You've got to reinterpret the Constitution in order to get them. Bork says the orthodoxy of original understanding and the political neutrality of judging it requires are anathema to the liberal culture that for 50 years has won a succession of political victories from the courts and that hopes for more political victories in the future. The representatives of that culture hate the American orthodoxy because they have moral and political agendas of their own that cannot be found in the Constitution. What they want to do things the Constitution won't let them do. Well, why do we need a new hermeneutic? Because you want to do some things that the Bible won't let you do. So you've got to reinterpret the Bible. What Judge Bork wrote about the courts could equally be said about the people in the Brotherhood who are always harping, we need a new way to interpret the Bible. Basically, when people talk about wanting a new interpretation, that's really not what they want. They don't want an interpretation, they want a misinterpretation. And we need to recognize, we ought to admit this, that anyone who loves God should be able to say, should be able to realize and proclaim that every passage of Scripture has a meaning that God intended when He caused that to be written, that He wanted to transfer the mind of God to the mind of man. And therefore, every passage of Scripture has only one interpretation. And anything that varies from that isn't an interpretation at all. It's a misinterpretation. And that's what these folks want. Original understanding is as relevant to the Bible as it is to the U.S. Constitution. And the winds of culture pose a drastic danger to anyone who dare to preach the gospel. Culture will threaten you with being outside the loop if you dare to preach what the Bible says. Countless people have surrendered, and in the process of surrender have made shipwreck of their own faith and the faith of others. Folks, you know who criticized the church more than anyone else in all the world? Those who were born and raised in it, inevitably. I wasn't born in the church. I floundered around in denominationalism until I was 28 years old. And I have no hesitation to tell you the Church of Christ has brought more blessings to the McDowell family than anything that ever happened in our lifetime. There is nothing more wonderful than the Church of our Lord. It breaks my heart for those who've never known anything else to stand up then and ridicule. They need to be lost as I was and realize they were lost in order to appreciate the greatness of the wonderful blood-bought group of people that we are privileged to wear the name of Christ and call ourselves the Church of Christ. But these people grow up in the church and fulfill what Shakespeare wrote of Brutus. He put these words on the lips of Brutus, rather, whenever Brutus was contemplating how Caesar was becoming too powerful. And listen to what Brutus said as he contemplated how powerful Caesar is becoming. He might become emperor. Oh, he might seize too much power. And Brutus said, "For 'tis a common proof that lowliness is young ambition's ladder. But when it once attains the utmost round, it then unto the ladder turns his back, looks into the skies, scorning the base degrees by which he did ascend." And it breaks my heart to see people who have been trained in Sunday schools where people have given sacrificially to allow that little boy to grow up in that atmosphere, to then grow up and begin to ridicule the thing that made him what he was. That is the path traveled by good men who cannot resist the siren song of liberalism. They make shipwreck of their faith and others with them. During the age of inspiration, cultural pressures turn men into false prophets. Today it turns them into false teachers. And the church needs men like Jeremiah, willing to die in a dungeon for preaching the truth rather than live in a palace as a reward of preaching what a culture wants to hear. The church needs men like Haggai and Zechariah, who will stir up the people of God when they bow to a cultural wind that would have them cease their work. Thank you for your attention.